From the campus of the University of Kentucky, you're listening to Behind the Blue. I'm Cody Kaiser with UK Strategic Communications.
We study these things not because I care whatsoever if a student of mine can accurately sort broken ketchup bottles and ceramic dishes and put them into a nice typology, but more like, why would we care to study these ketchup bottles? Well, because of persistent stereotypes about Appalachian backwardness and hillbillyism, right? Like, whatever we teach through the social sciences is ultimately about transforming society and self.
That's Zeta Kamara, a lecturer in the Lewis Honors College and one of six recipients of the 2024 Great Teacher Awards, an affiliate faculty member in the Appalachian Studies Program and the Department of Anthropology. Kamara teaches interdisciplinary social science, material culture, archaeology of the recent past, Appalachia, oral history, and the social impacts of pseudoscience. Her research focuses on archaeologies of gender, race, and class, and their intersection with the consumer revolution in Appalachian coal towns and on modern material culture studies on UK's campus. She administers the UK Appalachian Center's Coal Camp Documentary Project, a collaborative documentation effort focusing on company coal towns in Kentucky's 54 Appalachian counties. The University of Kentucky Alumni Association started the Great Teacher Award program in 1961 to honor excellent teaching at the university. There have been more than 300 teachers honored since that first year. Nominations may only be submitted by current students. To receive the award, a candidate must hold the rank of full-time lecturer or above and have been a member of the faculty for the past 3 years at UK, have superior knowledge of the subject matter, have original and innovative classroom presentations, demonstrate concern for students both inside and outside the classroom setting, and not have been a recipient of the award for the past 10 years. On this episode of Behind the Blue, my colleague Steve Schaefer spotlights this Great Teacher Award winner.
Zeta Kamara, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, how did you find out that you were nominated to be a great teacher?
Oh, it was a good nomination reveal. I had no idea. I teach in the Lewis Honors College, so we teach seminars and we're encouraged to do creative things. So I was going on 3 hours of sleep, and I had a woman who owns a dance studio here in town, Terry Toom, come into my Ritual, Myth, and Magic class, and we were doing belly dancing. And So I danced my ass off for 50 minutes and then started teaching Knowledge and Society, which is my freshman foundation's honor seminar. And we were doing origami because we had read a podcast about memory and ethnicity and paper folding. So we're right in the middle of making cranes, and I'm like holding half of a crane up in the air. And the dean walks in the room with balloons, followed by the associate dean and like seven other people that I didn't know. And I was so tired. I just saw him come in and I was like, oh, what a weird time to get fired. Right in mid swing. And then, your rational mind catches up and you're like, no, that's not right. It'd be weird to give somebody balloons and then fire them. And I'm like, it's not my birthday. How embarrassing for him. And then I was like, wait a minute, what is happening? It was a good reveal. I had no idea. And all the students are also just sitting there with like a half folded paper crane, like, what's going on right now? And we're like, I don't know. What do you think's going on? It was great.
Well, I wish I could have been there for that one.
It was a good reveal.
You probably know this award is entirely student driven. They drive this forward. All the nominations come from students. They have to sort of, follow through and make sure that it's finished. What does it mean to receive an award like this that's so student-centric?
Winning an award like this feels like the ultimate metric, I think, of teaching excellence. You get a performance review every year, and you sit down with your bosses who are administrators, some of whom have a lot of teaching expertise, some not as much, and you talk about your performance and they set nice goals for you. Something like this is different. Something like this demonstrates that you made enough of a connection to change somebody's life as a learner and as a fellow teacher. And winning a student-driven award like this is, it's It's really the highest metric I ever wanted to achieve. Not really into being famous. I know that's a weird thing for someone with a PhD to say, but like, I'm not into like working for a publication mill. I'm not into being a renowned researcher. I just want to make a good connection with students. I want to be a good educator. I want to transform things locally, help folks think about how to transform things globally. And winning a teaching award means, you know, I'm doing good work and makes me proud to continue to try to develop in excellence.
Well, and in an institution like this, where it is very heavily research driven, you know, sometimes the run-of-the-mill teachers sort of sometimes will get lost in the hubbub of a lot of that. And so that's what I think, why I think this is really cool. They've kept this award for, you know, the early 60s, I believe, is when this was started. And so, but they've kept it, you know, sort of good teaching at the forefront. And I think it's really cool.
I know. I love that. I think it's cool too.
I've been in your class and I've seen what you bring. But so trying to put into words, what do you hope to bring to class to maybe sort of motivate and inspire students?
I love to bring my authentic self to class. Sometimes I think the dean would wish it was a little less authentic. But in order to make a connection with people, you have to keep it real, you know? And for some people, that means being like very serious and very formal, and that works for them. For me, I like to be funny. I was liked in the Anne of Green Gables movie where she said, if you're going to present publicly, you make them laugh or you make them cry. And I always, as a kid, thought, why not do both, right? Present things with so much gravitas that people are moved emotionally, but also like make them laugh, make them want to participate, make them want to have fun, make them feel weird and uncomfortable and delighted and joyful. So I like to bring a mixed bag to class, but I like to be intentional about it, you know, and I sort of like to, you know, get sort of like a feedback from the energy of people in the room. And if you bring it, they bring it, and then you bring it harder, and then everyone's bringing it.
That's a really great way to put that. Like, you know, I am the same in my classes. I'm trying to be the comedian to varying degrees of success, you know. And I also, you know, have to remember that I'm 54 and they're 20. So, you know, you have to land the jokes just right or in the right context before so they will get them. But how do you think an award like this will carry forward in your teaching? How do you think it'll sort of manifest itself?
I think this award will help me carry forward in my teaching because it's an excellent motivator. Right? I think you could easily win an award like this and say, I've done all I need to do here. Psh, tap out, right? I'm the best. But I think something like this for me, it's good motivation to continue to try to learn more, like develop more pedagogically, develop in my interpersonal skills. It's nice to be seen, though. It's nice to be validated. It's nice for folks to say, like, hey, you did make an impact and this changed my life. And you can say back to them, like, same, you know, thank you for reminding me that I do love to do this and that I want to continue to get better at it.
Do you have a teaching philosophy?
Yeah, of course, everybody has a teaching philosophy.
I mean, I know you have to sort of write those things out, but do you have one, you know, for you?
Yeah, I mean, I have the standard pillars of honors education teaching philosophy. Like, it better be creative, outside the box, student-led. It better be about community building. That last one for me is the big one. For me, teaching is first and foremost about community building, and education follows from that lead, right? If you make a connection with people, if you make them care about you and about other people and about themselves, they care about learning, right? Because learning facilitates all of those things, and it facilitates like self-discovery and self-authorship, right? And so my philosophy is it's really about community building. Talk to people like they're real people. I think this is a primary mistake that faculty make, and for a lot of good reasons, right? Those of us who are women and queer, people of color, neurodivergent folks, we think, you know, to be too real, to try to make too much of a connection is to cede your authority. It's to become more precarious. But I have found just the opposite. The more community building you do, the more real you are with people, the more of a connection you try to make, the easier it is for everyone to teach and learn transformatively, right? I really believe in that. And I feel absolutely privileged to teach in honors in a place where people are there to do the good thing. They are not just there for the fancy mattress and to get the best grade and to put that on their CV. People are there because they give a shit about other people. They give a shit about humanity and they want to do something transformative and they are thirsty for connection. And that is what I love about teaching, and that's the first thing I try to foster. And I truly think everything else comes from that, right? If you can look a student in the eye and you say, "Hey, Elizabeth, how's your Baldur's Gate 3 character development coming? Like, how are your stats? Is that romance arc working out for you?" Guess what? That person wants to learn, right? Because you see them and they see you. So I guess part of my teaching is also to steal a phrase from the great oral historian Alessandro Portelli, who's done some great work in Italy, Tucky. He calls oral history a mutual sighting, and that is how I feel about teaching too, that it cannot work without a mutual sighting. Otherwise, it is always an exercise in inequitable power instead of a mutual collaboration, like fostering mutual humanity.
Well, the thing I've noticed, you know, in my classes particularly, they learn as much from each other as they learn from
right?
me. Like, you know, and I expected that, you know, going in. I haven't taught a lot, but I've, you know, it's been a fairly intense ride. And, you know, I learn as much from them as they learn from me. And I, you know, I approach it similarly, that it's more of a conversation and it's not, you know, I have to do a little bit of that, but it's not a me standing and delivering. It's me sitting at a table with them and, you know, we're editing video together and that kind of thing. And so, you know, and they start to pick up and learn bits and pieces independently. And then what this one doesn't know, this one does, and they teach each other. And so that's the best of it, I think.
Absolutely, right? One thing I really love about honors is it's about the co-creation of knowledge and the co-creation of authority, right? Everybody bringing some sort of mutual expertise into the classroom and leveraging their specific expertise and their specific positionality, right? And I think I'm really privileged to work in a space where students are treated and feel like junior colleagues, because they are, right? And that gives me the ability to never stop learning, which is great, because then I don't get bored.
Right. And that, you know, and I'm also honest about it with my students, as I'm sure you are. It's like, I own up to what I don't know, and they know things that I don't. And so, you know, it becomes, you know, a real give and take. And I love that part of it. So.
Me too.
What motivates you? Why do you keep teaching? I'm sure there's a place in the world out there for you somewhere, but why do you keep teaching?
I think what motivates me to keep teaching is that I love to learn. I love to learn about people, and I love to learn with people. I guess that's why I became a social scientist. Also because I'm like a social deviant, as a, you know, a former and current weird kid. I like connecting with people, which is something that I had to learn as a neurodivergent kid. You know, you spend like 15 years just watching everything and learning the rules. And then you get to learn when you're an adult why they seem natural. And then you get to learn about subverting them. And that's what I love about social science. And I love learning about social science with students, because helping other people parse the veil with you and denaturalize social life is just so transformative, where you get to have an aha moment once a week where you're like, hey, this isn't that natural after all. And if it's not given, if it's constructed, we could change it, right? And that's so fun. I love my subject matter. I love to keep learning about people and society and interaction and materiality. And also, I just feel the best. I feel the best teaching, I've decided. I could have been good at a lot of stuff, according to my mother. She's very sweet. But something about teaching has held my interest longer than anything else has. And I think that's because I feel invigorated by being around a lot of smart, committed people and being challenged and being productively uncomfortable and having fun and having frankly, a weird non-standard job, right? What other job do you have where you could, in the same week, like belly dance, do origami, study trash on campus, vomit cigarette butts, beer cans, etc., help somebody write a research paper, apply to grad school, and, you know, also work on a publication about Appalachia? Where else could you do that? Where else do you have the freedom to be so transformatively weird while doing something that like fosters better citizens of humanity? I just love it.
I couldn't have said it any better. I don't think that was amazing.
Thanks, Steve.
I've had real jobs and I don't like them. Like I've only had a couple and I wasn't very good at them. So, you know, I sympathize. Like, just, it's really great to just be, yeah, you know, in a space like this, on a campus like this, where, you know, you can just be your normal, weird self, whatever range that is, you know.
Right.
And do creative things, yeah, you know, that help people.
The Academy is where all the smart, curious, uncomfortable weirdos come to learn about ourselves and other people and how the world works. And I think that's just really cool.
So you consider yourself to be an anthropologist.
Yep.
What are you trying to teach them besides anthropology?
That's a great question. So I'm a bit of an unusual academic. I always said it's lucky that I ended up in honors education, which is interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary, because that's what I am. I'm the scholar that goes to conferences and is the only one of whatever. So I'm an archaeologist of the recent past. I've historically studied 20th century Appalachia, company coal towns. I teach for the Lewis Honors College. I teach interdisciplinary social science. So I teach about Appalachia and material culture and race and gender and pseudoscience and society and ritual, myth, and magic. So I teach a lot of different things, kind of all centered around materiality and representation. I'm also an affiliate faculty member in the Department of Anthropology, which is actually where I got my PhD. And I'm an affiliate in Appalachian Studies. And when people try to pin down, you know, hey, what is it you do? I'm like, oh, it's honestly, from an employer perspective, the CV from hell. It's all over the place. I've gotten really lucky that I get to explore, like take some intellectual risk and explore my passion. So I'm really interested in, you know, teaching about honors pedagogy, publishing about honors pedagogy. I'm also into archaeology of the 20th century. I'm into Appalachian studies and rural sociology. I'm into modern material culture studies, which is why I keep running around and documenting all the gross trash on campus. I'm really interested in scientific literacy and improving scientific literacy, like my own included. So I got really into pseudoscience after teaching a pseudo-archaeology class in the anthropology department. So kind of all over the place. But I guess if I could summarize, you know, what I want to teach folks is basically cultural relativism, right? The idea that no human behavior is naturally given, right? That it's all constructed through these relationships that we have with a vast network of people and things, like all of our fellow social actors working in concert to constitute self and society. I think that's really cool. So that's the first part. And the second part, which is more important, you know, is about praxis, right? The intersection of theory and action. And this is, you know, why my motto for class, and students will repeat this, like, in here we give a shit, right? Like, we study these things not because I care whatsoever if a student of mine can accurately sort broken ketchup bottles in ceramic dishes and put them into a nice typology, but more like, why would we care to study these ketchup bottles? Well, because of persistent stereotypes about Appalachian backwardness and hillbillyism, right? Like, whatever we teach through the social sciences is ultimately about transforming society and self.
So outside of sort of a lot of those principles, what are the sort of intangible things that you're trying to teach them? Like the, you know, I say it to my students and I get eye rolls, but, you know, and I say, look, you know, we're not, like, we're building a life here. We're not training for a specific thing because you're probably not going to have one job for the rest of your life. You know,
yeah.
This is like, we're building a life and we're learning how to learn and, you know, that's how we move forward and have a good life. So what are you trying to teach them, sort of those intangible skills?
I love teaching intangible skills. I like to really help students and myself cultivate a really intentional sense of self. I like students to come away, these are my learning outcomes for everything, really, is I like students to come away thinking about structural inequality and their role in structural inequality and how they can help mitigate this both on the small scale through everyday actions and through collective action, the transformation of society and structure and systems. I also like to work on just some basic psychology, right? I think we all need to cultivate you know, good senses of self-authorship. Confidence is a big one, a big intangible. When you teach in honors, you're around a lot of really smart, high-achieving people who have traditionally worked to have the highest marks possible, quantitative metrics, which I hate, right? But I guess we have to have them. I'm told by the university we must have these things. But I like students to, you know, I like students to sort of get beyond their nervousness and anxiety about institutionally rated performance and take a higher, more qualitative metric, right? Do you believe in yourself? Do you walk into a space with confidence in your own expertise? Can you walk into a room and make a connection with somebody else that is transformative? It's really the little things, right? I want everybody to be confident. I want everybody to feel proud of themselves. I want everybody to work on collaborating with other people so that they also feel that way. I want folks to be able to work with other folks to do something collaborative that is transformative. I want people to write good emails. There's lots of good intangible things about being a teacher. I want people to be confident when they go to a job interview. I want people to be confident when they ask someone out on a date, right? Or even a platonic hangout. I want folks to learn social skills in my class, right? There's a lot of intangibles that I think are maybe more important than any course curriculum that we teach because they are transferable to any passion, any hobby, any job, right? If you are confident in your own expertise and also humble enough to admit that you're wrong, take intellectual risks, and learn collaboratively with other people, you're pretty much set for human life.
Absolutely. Like that's, you know, and that's part of, you know, what I sort of take as a little bit of the mission, you know, with my teaching as well. My classes are much smaller than yours, so I can maybe even
That's so cool.
Get a little more personal, you know, with
yeah.
them. But yeah, I mean, it goes back to the, you know, whatever it is, we're learning how to learn. And so, and then if you know how to learn, then you can learn to do anything.
Right.
So you've been talking about your students quite a bit. So, but let's talk about them specifically. Tell me about your students. What are they like? How do they inspire you? And maybe what do they teach you?
Well, I'm really lucky. My students in the Lewis Honors College are brilliant, informed, curious, kind, dedicated, anxious, strange, wonderful people. I love them so much. I can't honestly imagine working with another population of people. I don't know about you when you teach, but every semester, you get anxious at the beginning, like, what if they're never that cool again? What if my last class was the coolest group of people I will ever meet? What if these people aren't cool? And then they show up in the first couple of weeks, you make all these connections. They're like, oh no, this is great. Everyone's great. This is honors. We're here to, we're doing a thing here, and this is wonderful.
Every semester.
Right? I don't know, something about it. I get really excited for the first day of class, but then I walk in, I look around, I'm like, look at all these randos. They'll never replace Cade and Livy and Kyle. And then 2 weeks later, you're like, this is awesome. We're best friends. We're like colleagues, and I love you all. And they're like, whoa, Dr. C, too much. But I mean it. I have no problem making connections in honors. And I think it's because we are attracting a specific kind of person who wants to do things like community building and make a connection beyond just like replicating certain kinds of academic work and research and test taking. And that's really great. And I have learned, man, I have learned so much from students. I credit students with knowing almost everything that I know in a real sense about social justice. It's easy as an academic to read a lot of theory and read a lot of case studies and feel that you are informed, but you know, literacy and competency is lived, right? That comes through interaction, that comes through lived experience. And students have taught me a lot of stuff, right? Not just the specifics about like, here's what disability justice does, and here's what you should or should not say to someone using a wheelchair, right? It's more like, you know, how can you develop real empathy because someone has taught you something real that changes your life? And I love learning stuff like that from students. I like to learn all sorts of pop culture references and slang from them. I do a slang collection project, and then I like to let at least one a semester rip in a faculty meeting so I can teach everybody else. It's just so fun. I like to learn about technology from the students. Sometimes I'm like, what do you mean you guys can't use Microsoft Word? And they're like, Dr. Z, what do you mean you didn't know there's a lock screen function on your iPhone that lets you read in bed without the screen flipping? I'm like, no, surely not. So embarrassing. I learn all sorts of stuff from them. I guess maybe the big one, honestly, is social skills. I guess when you're interacting with a lot of high-level peers all the time, you know, there's all this pressure to, quote-unquote, do it right, replicate the system, follow the rules, say the right thing, be the right person. And with students, they're just simply not so jaded yet. Right? Like, students are young enough, I think, that they retain a sense of wonderment that I hope that I can cultivate until I die. And I learn, you know, I've learned a lot about, like, not being so anxious about performance all the time and being vulnerable and making a real connection and, like, I hate to use like a market metaphor, but like capitalizing on that vulnerability because it spends, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, and it goes back to those connections. The more you let them get to know you, the reverse happens. That's what, you know, that's what's so amazing. And honestly was a little unexpected. Like I've been a photographer and a producer, you know, for 30 years. Teaching has sort of been a recent thing. And so a lot of that stuff has sort of surprised me a bit, you know, at how connected and invested, like they're mine now. Like I'm invested in these kids. And so, you know, and I keep up with them and I make sure that they tell me what's going on and that I can be a resource. And so that part was a little unexpected. It was in my head a little bit. It's you bring a group in and you get a semester and you wipe that group out, and then, but it's not been that for me at all. Like it's been very, they revisit. And so, and it's really great. And I love that part.
Well, I can tell you're a good teacher too. That's how you know. Repeat offenders,
I guess so. Yeah. But it's been really great and been really, really surprising. So we've all sort of had a rough few years here, I still like to ask this question. I know we're sort of outside the pandemic, but I still feel like, and I see it in my students, we're still feeling the effects of it. How have your students sort of surprised you or maybe inspired you in the last few years of sort of how they've risen to a difficult time? And even once we got back, it was still a little difficult sort of, we pivoted really quickly out and we eased back in and it was, you know.
Yeah.
I still think it's, you know, there's still a little weirdness in society and particularly amongst young people.
Yeah. I mean, the pandemic sucked, no doubt. And also, I think it revealed a lot of wonderful things that we were not perhaps discursively aware of before. And one of those things for me was just how students just almost natively do mutual aid for each other and for their communities and just show up to help each other and check in on each other and really care. It was amazing, I think, for me to see during the pandemic how vulnerable my students were with each other. I'm over Zoom when we're all, you know, sitting in various weird situations. Half the people probably aren't wearing pants, and every like 15 minutes somebody's dad would yell something weird in the background, and like students were still so present and so focused and really saw each other. People could tell when somebody was not okay and would ask them about it, you know, on camera and say, hey, let's go in virtual office hours together and talk to Dr. Z about it. And I was just blown away by how much students really cared about each other and realized that that was the most important thing, not whether they kept up on their academic studies during that time, which was an unsettled, liminal, weird situation at best and a deeply traumatic situation at worst. Students just showed up for each other. And that was an amazing lesson. You live in the United States and you learn about how individualistic we are as a social scientist, and you see that play out every day. And then you realize that, you know, collectivity has always been alive and well, and that maybe we just weren't seeing it. And maybe people weren't called to action like they were during the pandemic. But I think it was surprising for a lot of us when I think we assumed, all of us, myself included, would retreat further and become more individualistic, that we really collectivized. Not to blow Andy Beshear's major talking points here, but he's not wrong about that, you know? We got through it together. And I can deeply credit my students with getting me through the pandemic, which was just, on one hand, one of the calmest times I've ever had as like an introvert, being left alone in my house for most of the time, except when I was, you know, on Zoom having great conversations with students. It was like a very calm time. I kind of like liminality as a weird person. But also it sucked. My dad died during the pandemic. He was also a college professor, and he died real slow in a hospital where no one was allowed in or out in 2020. And I had two students die during the pandemic. And then I had two colleagues die. And I had a friend die on the same day as my dad, who was my age, and another friend die of cancer, and a friend die by suicide, and a friend die from overdose. It just like went on. It was an absolutely brutal time. And for that 4 weeks that my dad died, my students would show up in my office hours, 20 of them at a time on Zoom, to hang out. They kept saying to hang out. We miss you. We miss each other. We're bored. My dad won't even let me go to Kroger. All this. I'm sure all of that was true. All of that was definitely true. But, you know, they were keeping me company. And they would just, you know, I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't know what to do. You know, like, how do you entertain people when you're when your dad is dying and the world is burning, right? So I was like, you guys want to watch me bake a cake? And they're like, very much so. Can we get involved with the cake? And that stuff, man, that stuff really got me through it. It really was. They just kept showing up day after day to do whatever, play board games together, to tell each other about our day, to everybody showing stuff in their house. Look at my thing. You know, the era of here is my cat. Please admire. I don't know. And just like even just showing up, people were just showing up because they wanted to be there. So much so that I realized that students were skipping other classes to come to my virtual office hours because it was such a good community space. But I get it. It's the thing that I turned on for and checked in for every day. Just a wonderful moment of community building that I wasn't getting with colleagues who were all like dealing with their own struggles and burnout and blown out. And, you know, they didn't want to have Zoom parties and we were all tired of Zoom faculty meeting. And so I'm like looking at their posts on Facebook, like, I'm worried about you. It appears that all you've eaten for the past 20 days is nachos and red wine. I'm like, are you okay? But like, everybody just kind of isolated, like faculty and staff wise, but the students didn't. They just, man, there's this term from anthropology, communitas, which is this deeply, deeply felt sense of community and belonging. And it often happens during liminal times, like times of stress and collective trauma. And the students were just, I mean, they were the embodiment of communitas. And it was one of the nicest surprises I've ever had, I think, as a teacher, that people really care so much. And even when they can give up and nobody will penalize them for it, that they want just the opposite.
That may be the most beautiful pandemic story I've ever heard. Like, that's really awesome, like to hear that. And, you know, the thing that I see in my students is, and I absolutely encourage this, is for them to sort of be able to say to me and to themselves, I'm not okay and I need a minute. And so that's, and I feel like to some degree, students now are a little better about that.
I think so too. Yeah. I think so too. We learned something.
Yeah.
It was a very hard learned lesson.
It was a hard lesson, for
but,
sure.
But I think we did learn something. I think my students are much more willing to ask for help, to disclose struggles with mental health, to admit that they feel vulnerable or are vulnerable or are precarious, to, you know, even just to say, something's up and I'm not sure what it is and you seem like a person I could talk to about it. And that's really great.
I encourage my students, you know, like, it doesn't have to be me. It can be me.
Yeah.
But find your people.
Yeah.
And lean on those people. They won't mind if you lean on them, if you find the right people. And so, you know, that's another interesting, you know, maybe unexpected sort of turn of teaching that I wasn't sort of necessarily thinking about going in. But
yeah.
Speaking of students who might struggle a little bit, and, you know, your students seem to naturally have found their own way to sort of cope. But what advice would you give to students who maybe need a little extra or maybe need a minute or whatever? You know, what's your advice to them?
I give students the advice a lot to listen to themselves. People know when they're not okay. And I think the tendency for a lot of us is to sort of tamp that down, shut it out, say, I can get through the day. Of course, you can get through the day. We've all learned how to do that since we were kids. It's not about getting through the day. It's about admitting that you don't want to go through every day just getting through the day, right? And being honest with yourself first and then go be honest with somebody else is what I tell them. Like, I don't care who it is. It could be me. It could not be me. You know, it could be somebody at the Disability Resource Center. It could be somebody at the Counseling Center. It could be the dean. It could whoever, right? Your mom, somebody else's mom, if she's cooler. You know, just go be honest with somebody and say, something's up. I always tell them that they don't even have to have a reason for why things are not okay. Just express that they are not to me and or someone else, and then we can work from there. I think students need to hear, like, concisely that they do not need to understand everything that is happening to them when things are going wrong. That exploration can happen after the initial admittance that something is wrong, right? And then we can figure out what that is. And I think that's really transformative for people who, I don't know, I guess have just been conditioned through various things like the academy, their families, their church, whatever, to, you know, always have an answer, you know, always have a justification, always have an action plan. And that's what I like about honors. We don't need any of those things. In fact, I think it's probably better to build them along the way.
What does it mean as a teacher, and maybe what does it mean to the department, you know, university, whoever, what does it mean to have students who have gone through your world and are out in the larger world doing cool things, doing big things? Maybe they just went home and are doing things at home. What does it mean to have those students out in the world doing cool things?
It means the world to me to have students out in the world doing cool things, and keeping in touch with me about it, because that's, I think, another big metric of success for me. Like I said, I don't really care about being a widely published author, although I suppose I should care a little bit more. I care when students come back and report to me that they are now teaching in a classroom and have questions about pedagogy and have some ideas for me on how to improve my pedagogy or a class that they have taken. I love when they come back and we have lunch and they tell me, you know, I got engaged, or I realized I'm asexual, whatever. You know, I love to have people come back and tell me anything. Come back and tell me, I've decided to blow the academy because this is not where my heart is and the money sucks and I want to go do something that's not my calling and just have a good job and go home to my family every day. Whatever it is, I love to see students become successful in however way they define that, because that means that I have had some part in that success, I think. And then, you know, they continue to have a part in mine. I really like that. I like keeping in touch with alums, and I do keep in touch with a lot of them, which is nice. They owe me after I write them 8 letters for graduate school, frankly. They should come back and eat a bagel with me. No, I'm just kidding. But they should, though. But it's just, it's so nice. I always saw my dad keep in touch with alums. My dad was an award-winning college professor. Rest in power, Denny. What a yahoo. He kept it real also. He kept it too real. And I just had this moment of realization when I was younger, not to make this sound like really paternalistic, because I hate when people frame teaching as like paternalism, but I realized when I was a kid, like, Dad doesn't have 2 kids. Dad has 10,000. And that was, you know, really apparent to me when he got cancer, which is not what killed him. He died during COVID. But when he had cancer, my mother had to unplug the telephone because students and former students, particularly alums, would not stop calling the house. And I was like, there's your sign that you've done a good job. You've been a transformative teacher. Like, do they keep in touch with you? Do they want you to be a part of their life? You want to be a part of their life? You know, do you want to share in their success? I think that's just so cool. And that's part of the reason that I wanted to become a teacher, just watching how transformative it was for my dad and for everybody that he knew. It's pretty cool.
That's amazing to have that as a reference,
yeah,
as a touchstone for your teaching to look back at his.
Yeah.
So what would you like to say to the Alumni Association, who has kept this award going through, as we've just talked about, some trying times over the many years that this award has been around? But they've felt, you know, it's important enough to keep good teaching first and foremost at the forefront, to keep this going. So what would you like to say to the Alumni Association?
I would like the Alumni Association to know that this means the world to people who win it. That this is a metric of success beyond any pay raise, performance review packet, stamp, inclusion in a massive publication, being on the news, being recognized in a professional society. It's this. This thing is the most meaningful thing. And I think this is even more meaningful. You know, and during the corporatization of the academy, when this is treated like a business and students are treated like consumers and education is a product that they buy. And it's just so dehumanizing. An award like this really humanizes things. It recognizes the connections between and among teachers and students. And I think it's a salve for a lot of us as we get, honestly, you know, get jaded, get disillusioned with the adjunctification of the American Academy and the attack on tenure and the focus on research at an R1 at the expense of like good classroom education. And this just shows that we do have that here. Number one, that the University of Kentucky is a leader in actual education, not just in product. And I think this is an incredible motivator for teachers here to be recognized for something that is actually meaningful to them and not something that they are told should be meaningful because they are jobbing correctly, 100% job. This is real, and I think the Alumni Association should know that this is real and that this means a lot.
What would you like to say to the student, Jack, that nominated you?
Jack. God, I love him so much. I want that on the record. Jack has been one of the most special people I have ever interacted with at the university, which is awesome because we have just a pantheon of special people in honors. A student that showed up in my modern material culture class and said, I am a physicist. And I said, congrats, you're the first one I've ever had. And everyone around you has had at least some exposure to social science. And he was like, I haven't. And he just showed up every single day having not just read the material, but really gotten into it. And I remember moments in discussion, just looking at him and thinking like, you need to get the hell out of here and into a grad seminar. Like, why are you here? And like, why are you so good at social scientific analysis? Like, no offense to physics and computer sciences, but this is just going to be wasted over. That's a rude thing to say, but I was just so blown away with Jack academically. And it's not just because he's a high level performer and did all the work, but because he showed up every single day ready to be unsure and uncomfortable, ready to experience growth, and ready to make somebody else in the classroom experience growth as well. And I used to think every single day that he was a tide that raised all ships in that classroom, because I know other students in that class watched him and just thought, what the absolute hell? I thought this guy was a physics major and he is just smoking everyone. And so many smart people in that class, and they really, I don't know, they really empowered each other. And Jack was a super strong part of that and is just the absolute loveliest person with just a depth of soul and emotion and intellectualism that I do think will change the world and has definitely personally changed my life. It's pretty awesome when you can show up and look around in a classroom of people and look them in the eyes and honestly say, I like you, I love you, and you're an amazing scholar, and I respect you. And I can say all of those things without hesitation about Jack. And he's one of those students that is like, feels like a metric of my own success. I like that he's out there in the world and that he's going to do good stuff, and he's going to do it way better than I ever did it. Not that he has to. Jack, you can do anything you want. You should know that, buddy. You're not here to make me happy, but it does make me really proud.
Yeah, and it is really gratifying to see students like that and know they're going to be way better than me.
So much better.
And I'm okay with that. Like,
I know. I love that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I look around the room in my classrooms and I'm like, everyone's so smart. Am I that smart? Like, I'm just older. I've read more. Like, I have a wider exposure to the literature. But am I smart? Like that? I don't know. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, you know?
Right.
Because they are. And that's what's really cool.
I have the 17-year-old daughter at home that keeps me humble.
Yeah, the dancer.
And, yeah, the wicked smart 17-year-old, and so, you know, and she's my test subject for a lot of stuff for my classes. But Dr. Z, as your students call you.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Blue. Behind the Blue is a joint production of the University of Kentucky and UK Healthcare. For more stories about UK and UK Healthcare, visit uknow.uky.edu.